I'm John Dankosky from Next and the New England News Collaborative. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers, or CBP officers, are legally allowed to stop individuals within 100 miles of any external boundary in the U.S. What this means is multiple checkpoints in places like New Hampshire over the past few years, where CBP officers stop and question passersby. CBP has said that the aim of these checkpoints is to enforce immigration law. And while many in the state have protested them, others do support them, but for a different reason: drug enforcement in the midst of an opioid crisis.
If somebody catches a heroin dealer in my community and puts them in jail, I'll shake their hand twice, you know?
That's John Payne from Lincoln, New Hampshire. But Gilles Bissonnette, legal director for New Hampshire's ACLU, says these stops aren't stopping drug trafficking.
These are family members, these are kids, these are parents, these are not drug dealers, as people have been suggesting.
Now, these checkpoints, miles away from the border with Canada, are an increasingly visible reminder of the fact that almost all of New England is within the boundaries of U.S. Customs and Border Protection oversight. And while there's nowhere near the security presence that you'll find on our southern border with Mexico, our nation's border with Canada has become increasingly tightened. But because this is the longest international boundary in the world, there are still a lot of wild places and big gaps where it's easy to still walk across undisturbed. That's the subject of Porter Fox's new book, Northland, a 4,000-mile journey along America's forgotten border. In it, he details his own travels along the northern border, a trip he made on foot, by boat, and by car, along the winding, often remote U.S.-Canada border, starting in the state where he grew up, Maine. Porter Fox joins us now. Porter, welcome to Next. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your book charts your journey along America's northern border, and the line itself in your journey starts somewhere off the coast of Maine. Maybe you can describe the start of the border for us and what it's like there.
It's kind of hard to find, actually. It's the easternmost point in America, continental America, and you can kind of go out to West Quoddy Head near the town of Lubeck, Maine, which is the easternmost town in the lower 48. And out at sea, there's no markers. There's, you know, really not much indication of where the border is. It's classic North Atlantic, slate gray ocean, giant swells, very stormy region. Some of the biggest tides in the world are there, in fact. And out there, there's, you know, kind of lobstermen and fishermen fighting about where the border actually is. And it wanders in towards the cliffs and goes up into Passamaquoddy Bay and the St. Croix River system and wraps around the panhandle of northern Maine and then shoots west toward the Pacific.
You talk about an island there in that borderland, Machias Seal Island, and it's one of the places along the border that it's a little unclear who owns it. Maybe you can talk about the story of that. Why isn't it completely settled where the sovereignty lies on that island?
You know, it's pretty indicative of a lot of confusing points along the border. There's about a dozen gray areas, they call them. And it's just where both countries claim jurisdiction. You know, there's documentation that supports both arguments. Canada goes back to language in royal charters that granted the islands along the coast to Canada. And then after the American Revolution, there was different language in the 1783 Treaty of Paris, which gave those islands to the state of Maine and to the United States. So, you know, it's conflicting language. It's been fought over for many, many years now. And to be honest, it's one of those things that when there's an election, when there's sort of a political event happening, something like that, it pops up in the news. But it's happened many, many times, and they just haven't resolved it. And this time around, it's very fertile lobstering ground. So, you know, with the decline of the fishery in the Gulf of Maine and end of the cod fishing and a lot of ground fishing up there, Nova Scotia fishermen were looking to make some money, and so they started setting traps on Machias Seal Island, which had traditionally been an American lobstering ground. So that's when the fighting began, and it's just kind of escalated from there.
It seems surprising that not just in this place, but in other places that you chart, as you mentioned, there is this kind of gray zone. Should we be surprised that in 2018, these two countries haven't completely settled on where the border is?
Absolutely. I mean, there's sections of the border in Minnesota's boundary waters that literally weren't even marked with monuments until the early 1900s. It's a border that has kind of been taken for granted. You hear a lot of headlines about the southern border, a lot of fuss about every mile of that border and what's going on there. And yet in the north, there's entire sections of the boundary that are either unmarked or undecided. It's the world's longest international boundary. It's also the world's busiest international boundary with $1.6 billion in goods and services, 400,000 people legally crossing it every day. So it's vital to our economy. It's vital to our relationship with Canada. Having disputes like this along the border and having, for example, the French teenager that jogged across the beach in Blaine, Washington a couple months ago ends up in a detention center. Well, I've been to that beach. There are no signs. There's no indication of stop here, turn around, you're crossing into America. It's just a beach. There's hundreds and hundreds of places like that along the border. And almost every time I visited it on these various trips, I would see something that, you know, I just couldn't believe.
Let's loop back to the place where we start. And you have a beautiful passage here near the beginning of your book when you spend the first few days of your trip across the border in Maine's Northland. And I'm wondering if you can do a brief reading for us.
Absolutely. On a map, the boundary is a line. On land, it passes through impossible places. Ravines, cliff bands, bogs, waterfalls, rocky summits, white water that few people ever see. 90% of Canadians live within 100 miles of their southern border. 12% of Americans live in the Northland, and most of them in cities like Seattle, Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, and Cleveland. Camping 30 feet from an international border was unsettling as well. It struck me that if someone was trying to sneak across, their greatest find would be an unarmed solo camper with a boat and enough gear and food to survive for a month. No matter what CBP had said, no one was watching this section of the boundary. An hour later, a beam of light shot through the woods. The glare was too bright to be a flashlight. I thought it might be a vehicle, and I crept to the riverbank to see. The beam came from the opposite shore. I walked upstream 100 yards and looked again. Across the river, I saw that the light was coming from the crest of a full moon rising over the treetops. Silvery light filled the forest. My hands were silver. The St. Croix was silver. I saw my shadow on the forest floor. It was unnatural. The glow was too bright to be the moon. Astronomers call the edge of sun or moonlight passing over the earth a terminator or a twilight zone. The zone moves 1,000 miles an hour on the equator. It travels at half that speed in the Northland. At the North Pole, you can walk faster than the Terminator, creating your own sunrises and sunsets. An otter slipped between my feet and disappeared into the river. I watched it for a moment, then walked back to my tent and stared at the changing light until I fell asleep. The emptiness of the Northland was unfamiliar to me. It was devoid of light, cars, people, trails, and roads. Clouds of stars glowed through the gaps in the tree cover. The forest was pure black where the moonlight was shaded. I grew up in this country, had explored it for 30 years, and thought I knew it. But this was different. The closer I got to the line, the more primal the terrain became.
Hmm. It's such a beautiful image of a place. And what strikes me is that, as you say, there are so many places along that northern border in which commerce is king, in which we have people driving by in cars just to go to a concert in Montreal or to take auto parts across to Detroit. But you're in a purely wild place there. And I wonder how that strikes you, that so much of this border is populated, is a place where two countries that have long time been allies are shaking hands. And in so many other places, you're just out there completely on your own.
It was the best part of researching this book was finding these wildernesses perfectly intact. You know, who knew that in Maine, the Northwoods are 12 million acres. It's bigger than two Massachusetts. It's so huge and untraveled and mostly roadless. I mean, really where I went, the only way in there was with a canoe. Before 2001, around half of the border crossings in the northern border were unguarded at night. That's the kind of terrain that is up there. Very sleepy towns, hundreds of miles of wilderness in between them. You have the Boundary Waters in Minnesota. You have Glacier National Park, North Cascades National Park, Maine's North Woods, like I said. I mean, these are some of the largest, most beautiful wildernesses that you really have to either bushwhack or canoe into, because they just, they've sort of been forgotten along with most of the northern border itself.
You did in that short reading, though, say something key. You mentioned that no matter what CBP said, no one was watching this section of the boundary. And maybe you can describe a little bit more the role that they play in the borderlands.
Well, Customs and Border Protection states on their website that their primary goal is stopping terrorists from entering the United States. And yet, that doesn't seem to be what they're doing, certainly not on the northern border, where the only known terrorist to sneak into the U.S. overland came from the north. There's been significantly more terror suspects arrested on the northern border in the last few years, according to FBI documents. It makes sense. It's the path of least resistance. There's huge gaps in this border. 2,000 agents watch, you know, this 5,500-mile-long line. The southern border is, you know, less than half as small, and you got more than 18,000 agents down there. There's just not enough people to do the job, not enough resources to do the job. So what you see is CBP setting up on Highway 95 in Maine, you know, 93, whatever, 100 miles south of the border, 50 miles south of the border, doing these spot checks. You see the ports of entry getting militarized and getting more aggressive with questioning and whatnot. But if you're just going to build up those ports of entry and that those kind of highway crossings and do nothing about the wilderness in between, it's not going to stop the problem that you say is your primary task.
Porter Fox is the author of a new book called Northland, a 4,000-mile journey along America's forgotten border. You can find an excerpt of the book, as well as photos of Porter's travels along the border, on nextnewengland.org. Porter, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listen to Next on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.